On the show today, former President Donald Trump found liable for fraud.
The judge found Trump and his company deceived banks, insurers, and others.
Plus, President Joe Biden joins American auto workers on strike.
On Tuesday, he became the first sitting U.S. president on a picket line, joining striking workers in the Detroit suburbs as they entered week two of their walkout seeking higher pay, a shorter work week, and other changes.
And later we go to Angola with the Secretary of Defense. We look at the economy in Zimbabwe, and we get a preview of the second Republican presidential candidates debate. Today is Wednesday, September 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. Biden on the picket line, that story coming up next. Now we take a look at news concerning a former president. A judge in New York has ruled that Donald Trump committed fraud for years as he built a real estate empire. AP's Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
In a civil suit brought by New York's attorney general, the judge found Trump and his company deceived banks, insurers, and others by massively overvaluing his assets. It wasn't just to brag about being rich, but rather that the lies on annual financial statements led to more deals, favorable loan terms, and lower insurance premiums. Trump has said a disclaimer on the statements absolves him of wrongdoing. The judge says it does not, in the strongest repudiation yet of Trump's carefully cultivated image as a rich and shrewd mogul. A non-jury trial will decide what punishments he faces. The attorney general wants $250 million in penalties and Trump banned from doing business in New York. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
On Tuesday, President Biden became the first sitting U.S. president to join a labor strike, standing with auto workers in Michigan as they campaign for a pay raise and a shorter work week. But can the top government employee move the top three automakers? VOA's Anita Powell reports from Washington.
Unions, President Joe Biden likes to say, built America. On Tuesday, he became the first sitting U.S. president on a picket line, joining striking workers in the Detroit suburbs as they entered week two of their walkout seeking higher pay, a shorter work week, and other changes from the nation's top three automakers. Biden has been careful to not say which terms he backs, saying instead that he supports workers' rights.
Stick with it, because you deserve the significant raise you need and other benefits.
Let's get it!
We get back who we lost, okay?
The president of the powerful United Auto Workers Union, which endorsed Biden's presidential run in 2020, but hasn't yet done the same for his 2024 bid, thanked him. UAW President Sean Fain.
Thank you for coming to stand up with us in our generation's defining moment.
The union claims more than 400,000 members. Many point to the sharp rise in company profits and CEO pay, but also the much smaller rise in worker pay. At a march last week, one worker said this strike is about much more than terms. It's about how Americans think about work and corporate compensation. Yolanda Downs is a UAW member.
I want the levels to be balanced. I want everyone to make a good living and a fair living. If I'm working on one side of the line and I'm making $30 and the person across from me is making $15 an hour, how is that fair?
General Motors, the largest of the big three automakers, avoided any direct comment on Biden's appearance, but issued a statement saying, "Our focus is not on politics, but continues to be on bargaining in good faith with the UAW leadership to reach an agreement as quickly as possible." Political science professor Susan Kang says Biden's decision to stand with workers is significant. But can he tip the balance of negotiations?
Probably not, because there's a lot of things going on in the specifics of the negotiations, but he can shift the political support. We already have an overwhelming amount of support from the public for the strike. And I think this is going to further legitimize the position of the striking workers.
Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump plans to rally at a non-union plant near Detroit on Wednesday instead of participating in the second presidential primary debate that day. In a statement, he dismissed Biden's Detroit trip as a PR stunt. Kang says many older politicians may be missing a broader movement among millennial workers.
I think that there's a wave, a tide towards greater intolerance of deep socioeconomic inequality that really has sort of characterized my lifetime.
But as Biden and Trump know, the pictures often tell a story of their own. Here is the top U.S. government worker saying, without needing to say a word, something needs to change. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is on a tour of African nations. On Tuesday, he was in Kenya and Angola. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling with the secretary and filed this report for us.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin visited a Kenya military base in Manda Bay near the Somali border, where a terrorist attack in 2020 killed three Americans. Perimeter security has largely improved since the attack. Kenyan and U.S. forces have added more barriers. The tree line that was once next to the base and had provided cover to the attackers, now hundreds of meters away from the perimeter. Kenyan defense forces showed off American-made helicopters, and U.S. forces displayed counter-drone equipment. Kenya's Secretary of Defense welcomed Austin at the base and called his visit a testament to the ever-strengthening bond between the U.S. and Kenya. He said both Kenya and the U.S. faced similar security challenges and must work together against common threats. Austin flew from Kenya to Angola, where he will meet with leaders Wednesday and give a speech at the National Archives. Carla Babb, VOA News, Luanda, Angola.
And here are other stories we're following from around the world. A fire at a wedding hall in northern Iraq has killed at least 100 people and injured 150 others, authorities said Wednesday. The fire happened in Iraq's Nineveh province in its Hamdana area. That's a predominantly Christian area just outside the northern city of Mosul, some 335 kilometers northwest of Baghdad. According to Ukraine's special forces, the commander of Russia's Black Sea Fleet, Admiral Viktor Sokolov, was killed in a Ukrainian missile attack last week on Russia's fleet headquarters in the Crimean port of Sevastopol. The Russian Defense Ministry has neither confirmed nor denied Ukraine's allegations. The Philippine Coast Guard said it removed a Chinese floating barrier that blocked access to a disputed South China Sea lagoon that was put in place last week. The action followed a statement by Philippine National Security Advisor Eduardo Ano, who said China's barrier violated traditional Filipino fishing rights. At least 68 people killed, hundreds injured, and about 100 more still missing after an explosion ripped through a fuel depot in the troubled autonomous Nagorno-Karabakh region of Azerbaijan. It appears as though the explosion happened as several hundred ethnic Armenians had gone to the fuel depot to get gasoline so they could flee the region. For the latest, I'm joined by Aram Avetsyan of VOA's Armenian service.
The latest information we received from de facto authorities on the ground that, as you mentioned, 68 people are killed and 20, they were able to identify only the identity of 21 person. The rest is still problematic since the explosion was so large, was so big, and the fire completely burned the people. At this point, we know that the 105 persons still missing, and according to the unconfirmed reports from the witnesses on the ground, and the de facto authorities reported about that, after the explosion, like 100 people were just burned because of the explosion.
We know there's been hostility in the region. Is there any indication yet what caused the explosion?
According, again, to the de facto authorities, the main, initially, and the main cause was negligence. At the same time, they mentioned that it's unlikely that was a result of kind of terrorist act or sabotage. At the same time, we know that this what happened right now, this big explosion, added to another humanitarian crisis, ongoing humanitarian crisis there, because there is an exodus of Armenian population, and already around 30,000 people left Karabakh, and this all so situation make difficult conduct proper investigation. All authorities are busy not only with this explosion situation, but also with this migration. What's happening on the ground?
I'm glad you brought that up. It seems that most of the victims, if not all of them, were ethnic Armenians who were at the fuel depot to get gasoline so that they could leave the region. What's happening? Why are they leaving the region in such large numbers?
It's a result of a long time Nagorno-Karabakh conflict on September 19th. If you the first in 1990s, Armenians were able to take control over the Nagorno-Karabakh Armenian population on the ground and won the war against Azerbaijan. In 2020, Azerbaijan returned most of the territories, and Russian peacekeeping contingent was deployed. However, this peacekeeping contingent was not able to provide enough security on the ground, and we had just recently had on September 19th, Azerbaijan launched the attack against Karabakh Armenians. In result, Karabakh Armenian local forces surrendered, disarmed, and now the population start leaving the region. Azerbaijan stressed that it will provide the security and the rights of Nagorno-Karabakh Armenians, but the problem is that there is a huge lack of confidence and trust between the sides due to this bloody conflict. That's why it seems that thousands and thousands of Armenians is leaving the region, and it seems that it's likely that vast majority of Armenians is going to leave.
Aram Avatsyan with VOA's Armenian Service. Aram, thank you very much for your reporting on this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. A look ahead to Wednesday's Republican presidential candidates debate in the United States coming up shortly. Now, the U.S. government alleges that Amazon.com has gone too far. Reuters' Elisa Bernard has more.
The U.S. Federal Trade Commission filed a long-awaited antitrust lawsuit against Amazon on Tuesday, claiming the online retailer harms consumers by keeping prices artificially high. It is the latest legal action by the U.S. government aimed at breaking big tech's dominance and comes after years of complaints that Amazon and other tech giants abused their control of search, social media, and online retailing to become gatekeepers of the most lucrative parts of the internet. The lawsuit, which was joined by 17 state attorneys general, follows a four-year investigation and federal lawsuits filed against Alphabet's Google and Meta Platforms, Facebook. In a statement, the FTC accused Amazon specifically of degrading quality for shoppers, overcharging sellers, and preventing rivals from fairly competing against the company, among other claims. The agency said it was asking for a permanent injunction ordering Amazon to stop its unlawful conduct. It also asked the court to consider forcing Amazon to sell assets to restore fair competition. Amazon said the lawsuit was wrongheaded and would hurt consumers by leading to higher prices and slower deliveries. The need to take action against big tech has been one of the few issues that Democrats and Republicans in Congress have agreed on. Tuesday's lawsuit is also not the first against Amazon by the FTC. The agency in June sued the online behemoth for allegedly duping millions of consumers into signing up for its paid subscription Amazon Prime service without their consent and making it hard for them to cancel. Amazon has called those claims, quote, false on the facts and the law. The company also faces suits from state attorneys general and class actions by individual consumers, exposing the retail giant to billions of dollars in potential damages. Amazon shares fell as much as 3.5% in Tuesday afternoon trading.
That's Lisa Bernard of Reuters. And some Zimbabweans living in abject poverty are reacting angrily to claims by President Emmerson Mnangagwa that the country's economy is the fastest growing in the Southern Africa region. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, where some economists and members of the main opposition say that the president is either being misinformed or does not understand basic economics.
At the just ended United Nations General Assembly, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa said his country's economy was the fastest growing in Southern Africa.
We are recording unprecedented development and economic success milestones. For the last 3 years, our country has been the fastest growing economy in our Southern Africa region. Further, Zimbabwe is prioritizing the eradication of poverty and improving the quality of life of our people.
Former Finance Minister Tendai Biti, a leader of the main opposition party, disagrees with President Mnangagwa's assessment of the economy. He says the president is seriously ill-informed and misinformed, as 79% of the population is living in extreme poverty.
Over a third have to rely on food assistance from the WFP and other UN agencies. More than 90% of the population is in formal employment. Everywhere where you go, there's decay in infrastructure, decay in the mindset. So there's a lot of propaganda, there's a lot of misinformation. This is a limping economy.
Prosper Chitambara is a senior economist with the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe. He says Zimbabwe's economy took a nosedive in 2019 and 2020 due to Cyclone Idai and drought. He is also concerned about the effect of inflation on citizens as well as poverty levels.
Our currency has been affected by the inflation. We've seen a depreciation of the currency. So the value obviously has been decimated by inflation.
Chitambara says that Zimbabwe needs to increase production and stabilize its currency so it can think of sustained growth and reaching an upper middle income economy, which President Mnangagwa wants to achieve by 2030. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
On Wednesday, September 27th, the top Republican presidential candidates will take to the stage in their second debate. This time around, the debate's location is perhaps as important as any issue the candidates will discuss. VOA's senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Prosciutti explains.
Here, in what is hallowed ground for many Republicans, top GOP presidential candidates will face off for a second time. This is the library of the 40th president of the United States, Ronald Reagan, who remains an icon for conservative Republicans.
Part of living better electrically.
He began life in the public eye as an actor and liberal Democrat before switching to the Republican Party. As a popular two-term president of the 1980s, he held up conservative values, pushing for small government, low taxes, and more money for defense. Known as the great communicator, some of his simple, direct words changed history.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Reagan has supplanted Abraham Lincoln is the most popular Republican in American history.
Craig Shirley worked for the Reagan campaign and in the Reagan White House. He's also written 6 books on him. He says the current Republican candidates will likely compare themselves to Reagan during the debate. They include former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, biotech investor Vivek Ramaswamy, and former Vice President Mike Pence.
Mike Pence certainly evokes Reagan-esque positions on issues, as does Nikki Haley, as does Ramaswamy.
Ramaswamy argued in the first debate that China is more concerning than Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Former U.N. Ambassador Haley questioned the younger candidate's lack of foreign policy experience. Reagan, who was the oldest president in history at the time, quipped about age during a debate.
I am not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience.
Again, the Republican frontrunner, former President Donald Trump, will skip this debate. In August, Haley called him the most disliked politician in America, and Christie and Pence called for his disqualification. But Ramaswamy called Trump the best president of the 21st century. Author Ian Morgan says Reagan would be uncomfortable with that type of discord and with the current tone of politics.
He was a very modest man, very personable man, and boasting did not come naturally to him. And that's something that isn't quite fitting into the current Republican mold.
But Reagan's memorable one-liners still work.
Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
That question remains a staple of presidential campaigns. On Wednesday night, presidential candidates will try to convince voters they can lead the Republican Party back into the White House. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, Simi Valley, California.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, the humanitarian aid sector is one of the world's biggest growth industries, according to the United Nations. That's because natural disasters, environmental degradation, and over 100 armed conflicts around the world are driving millions of additional people into poverty and hunger each year. We are now living with a series of concurrent and long-term crises that will continue to fuel global humanitarian needs, and this is happening just as funding for humanitarian relief operations is drying up, said World Food Program Executive Director Cindy McCain. Humanitarian needs are growing at a blistering pace, said United States Representative at the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield, and the gap between funding provided and UN-assessed needs stands at nearly $40 billion. Aid workers do what they can to save lives, but they need the international community to provide them with more resources, she said.
This moment calls for bold action. It calls for breaking out of our business-as-usual model. It calls for thinking holistically about how we address increasingly protracted crises. And it calls for everyone, not just member states, but everyone with the means to do their part.
One way to help end the suffering is to engage the private sector. In recent years, 4 of the largest logistics corporations, UPS, Agility, Maersk, and DP World, regularly joined forces in the logistics cluster led by the World Food Program, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. And in places like Haiti, where gang violence is impeding humanitarian access, the private sector is playing a vital role.
Commercial airlines have donated capacity on their existing routes to transport aid, while logistics providers ensured the smooth movement of life-saving supplies. The result? A watershed partnership that ensured cholera treatment reached people in need.
For too long, we have turned to the private sector exclusively for financing, and to its credit, it has shown enormous generosity, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. But in 2023, we know they have so much more to offer. Their capacities, their know-how, and innovations are tremendously needed.
The public sector must do more to proactively work with the private sector, especially as we look to advance the Sustainable Development Goals. The public sector must harness the expertise of the private sector and translate it into action.
It is past time for us to welcome the private sector through the front door, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. The world's most vulnerable are counting on us.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.